Hi, everybody, and we're going to continue now with the four objectives for all who seek to cooperate with the Great White Lodge. So the objective first is the working out of the plan and simultaneous working out of karma, and then contributing all one can to the forming the group of knowers, which we might look at, I suppose, as the new group of world servers. And it comes with a warning that we had better take advantage of the opportunity offered, or other channels will be selected. Then we've looked at number three. We have to cultivate the intuition at all costs. And we cannot compromise in this matter. And he gives us the method of doing so. It's fairly exacting. We have to recognize the ideal. We have to apply it through one-pointedness and remove the old hindering obstacles and not compromise, and we won't compromise if we have clear vision. And yet, in other places, he talks about a righteous compromise being necessary. But this is within the occult world itself, where no compromise is allowed. We have to continue to discriminate between the how an individual acts and the individual himself. So many people condemn both the sin and the sinner, but that is not allowed, because it is the behavior we seek to change while valuing the erring individual. And we're not allowed to interfere with personal karma, nor to shield others from the consequences of action. That's difficult for the second-rate types, I think. He says they have that shielding love, you know, and they may be guarding their near ones from the consequences of their actions, which simply delays the process. All right. So there are, in this number three, there are many strenuous demands if we're going to bring through what's found in the intuitive world. And now we are here with commentary number 32, and it's rule 4, and it's the fourth program in rule 4, thus 4.4. We're on page 137. The fourth result to be brought about, if we really want to cooperate with the Great White Lodge, by the present opportunity to work, is the bringing in the new cycle and the new group of participants. These have to appear. The bringing in, I suppose, of the new group of world servers, and the right inauguration of the new cycle, and that new cycle is imminent. We're in the period of the fading out of the old cycle with all the turbulence to be expected. Workers in the new era will be drawn from all groups, and the test of their choice depends largely upon the measure of impersonality with which they work and the strength of their inner contact with soul. Well, there we have it. Impersonality is going to be required, and a confirmation of their soul contact. So, impersonality, number one, and the strength of their soul contact. How does one judge those things? Okay, it is not easy for any of you, therefore, submerged as you are in the smoke and roar of battle, you know, of our daily lives even, to judge with accuracy or to judge people with perfect propriety, perfect correctness. These things have to be dealt with on the inner planes and are noted by the watching guides of the race. I would like here briefly to point out a few of the things for which the great ones look. Ah, requirement upon requirement is heaped upon us. And we have to find a way to live up to them. So we have to bring in the new age, the new cycle, working with the group participants we have to do this with. Impersonality. I often say that the impersonal worlds are the worlds of the spiritual triad and beyond, and the suprapersonal world is the world of the egoic lotus causal body on the higher mental plane, derived from experiences in the lower quarries of life, the lower 18 subplanes. So we cannot judge easily. Here's how the great ones judge. I guess that's what we're being told. The following have to do with how the great ones judge. What they look for in those who would cooperate with them. All this listing is about what has to be done or cultivated for cooperation with the Great White Brotherhood or Great White Lodge. They look to see whether the inner flame, the result of effort wisely to work and think and do, burns with increased brilliance. They note whether it remains hidden and dim through the whirl of astral currents and by thought forms of personal antagonism, ambition, and envy. As a result of world work, some will be drawn into closer connection with the work of hierarchy, and others will be temporarily set back. Capacity to dominate the astral and work from mental levels will largely count. Okay, so again, you know, I'm going to put that in as a as an A. Does the flame burn brightly? In other words, all of this is about what is our state of obscuration or revelation? And can we work from mental levels, subduing the astral vehicle and its obscurative tendencies? Obscurative. I'm going to just act as if that's a word. And tendencies is certainly a word. Okay. So that's A. This is what the great ones look for. What they look for in those who would cooperate with them. Because they cannot take in everyone. It would be against the law of economy, and there would be such a waste of time in trying to offset you. Well, I'm sure Master DK has done a fair share of offsetting, even with those that he found worthy to draw closer. Okay, now, point B, let's see. I'll call it B, you know. They look to see who can struggle and contend for principle with personalities and yet keep the link of love intact. You know, when Arjuna was to rise up and battle the members of his own family, that is, the aspects of his own energy system, which were inimical to the higher developments, he had to preserve his love. So is it possible to be a warrior and possibly inflict grave harm upon the form of another and still preserve one's love. That is a great discrimination. I'm reminded, you know, I saw long ago one of those series about Australia during and after the Second World War, and you know, the Australians were involved with the Japanese, and this particular Australian man was taken prisoner, and he was always acting up. You know, he was a wiseacre and didn't go along, you know, with his captors. And finally, they decided to do away with him, so they put him out in the sun. You know, which, who knows, 110, 120 degrees. With nothing to drink, and he would be dead before long. But as was the code of honor, the commanding officer of the Japanese forces asked him if he had any final request, and he said, yeah, I'd like a beer, a nice ice-cold beer. You know, my Australian accent is terrible, but okay. A beer. Well, the commanding officer could not honor that request. He didn't have one. And so honor forced him to release the man from his condemnation to basically be broiled out there. It is, he acted on principle, not, you know, he, and another story very similar, where someone spat at the commanding officer, at which point the commanding officer released him because the spitting had angered him, and he would not, his code of honor would not tolerate the arising of anger in the contending with the enemy. So, you know, there are those who have a very high code of honor when engaging in battle. Principles have to, the will, the higher sense of values have to be exalted over the tendencies of the personality. So, keeping love intact. This counts perhaps more than men realize, and a man who can stand for principle and yet love all human beings, refusing compromise and yet refusing hate, has something rare to offer in these days, and the great ones can use him. That's an amazing statement, and in these days of you know, political conflict such as I have not seen in my life, something to really ponder upon. I talked to a friend of mine whose wife was busy railing against the television because she hated the particular politician who was being presented or discussed. There's a reason to disapprove, perhaps, and even strongly condemn the kinds of thoughts and behaviors that are coming out of the opposition, but can the love be preserved? So can we contend? The great ones are looking for those who can contend for principle with personalities and yet keep the link of love intact. I just have to read this, even if for emphasis to myself. This counts perhaps more than men realize, and a man who can stand for principle and yet love all human beings, refusing compromise and yet refusing hate, has something rare to offer in these days, and the great ones can use him. See to it, therefore, all of you who work with that clear vision, upright purpose, and firm, undeviating action, that you forge ahead. See to it, therefore, all of you who work that with clear vision, now I'll read it correctly, upright purpose and firm, undeviating action you forge ahead. See to it that you deal with patience and forbearance with those of your brothers who choose the lesser principle and the lesser right, who sacrifice the good of the group for their own personal ends, or who use unworthy methods. And all I can think of at the moment is politics. Give to them love and care and a ready helping hand, for they will stumble on the way and sound the depth of the law. Stand ready then to lift them up and to offer to them opportunities for service, knowing that service is the great healer and teacher. Well, you know, this is the hierarchical attitude, and one has, you know, one must admit what sound advice it really is. Very sound advice. Now, let us go further along to point C. What else are the great ones looking for? The great ones look to see the faculty of pliability and adaptability working out, that faculty of adaptation that is one of the fundamental laws of species, which nature so wonderfully demonstrates. This is a third ray factor, and in the working out of the divine plan, there are so many circumstances that arise that require the necessity of intelligent change in unexpected conditions. The transference of this law to the inner planes and its working out in the new cycle of effort must be taken. In other words, let's just say we cannot remain rigid. Thereby lose opportunity. This law of adaptation involves the appreciation of the need, the recognition of the new forces coming in with the new cycle, and the consequent bringing together in a wide synthesis of the need and of the force, regarding the personal self simply as a focal point for action and transmutation. So, you know, we're not... Let's just say, we are not so attached to methods that we sacrifice objectives to the methods. It involves the transmutation of the five senses. You know, page 188 of Cosmic Fire, we deal with the higher senses there. The transmutation of the five senses and their extension into the subtler planes, so that sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell are welded into one synthetic cooperating whole for use in the great work. And maybe this welding is not only the... the common sense, number six, but the esoteric sense, number seven. On the physical plane, these tend to the unification of the personal life, you know, because when we cannot coordinate and correlate our senses, we live a very fragmented life on the outer plane. So these... senses together tend to the unification of the personal life and to the adaptation of the physical world to the needs of the personal self. So we learn how to, we might say, we learn, we learn how to handle the outer world according to our objectives, and we do this intelligently, changing method as needed. But on the subtler planes, these senses must be transmuted until they are adequate to the needs of the group of which the individual forms a fragmentary part. So this is all about the use of the higher senses for group purposes. The ability to do this is one of the things which the great ones look for in those individuals whose privilege it may be to inaugurate the new age. It is the age of Aquarius, but the inauguration of the age takes place very much under the impulse of Aries, the sign of initiative. So really, he's mentioned many things in this paragraph here that I'm marking C, pliability, adaptability, adaptation, blending the new force with the needs of the new cycle, and refining the senses and synthesizing them for use on the higher planes. Yes, use on the higher planes with the effect that the group cohesion and effectiveness can benefit. And then this would be point D. I don't know why it always runs like that, but it does. And every time I write a D, I get a disciple. So I have to go back and erase the disciple part. Above all, they look for an enlarged channel from the soul to the physical brain via the mind. Soul, mind, brain, it's a triplicity so oft repeated, and necessarily so. Such an enlarged channel indicates a man can be used, and the masters themselves can enlarge the channel when it is deemed wise to do so. I've told you, and you may have run into that section where FCD, Roberto Sagioli, the psychologist, disciple of Master Kutumi, and disciple assigned to help Master DK, was being discussed, and could they or would they enlarge the channel at this time, but they deemed that it was not wise to do so because he was already sufficiently sensitive. And, you know, if we pour in too much energy, we can disrupt a process or a form which is in good shape or sufficient shape, and we can delay progress and delay service. So a lot of wisdom is there required, just the same kind of wisdom in lesser degree that the initiator has when deciding how much force to apply to the vehicles of the candidate. How much force and of what kind and what order, you know. It's a great science. One might almost express it by saying that they look for the perfecting of the antiskarana, both are used, both terms, that channel of communication between soul consciousness and the brain, whose possessor is one whom the masters can successfully use. And this is the early antikarana, or earlier, before the connection to the spiritual triad is attempted, because we are speaking about the relationship of the soul with the brain via the mind. And later, that soul, in a way, becomes the spiritual triad, but in what is here being discussed for the aspirant to discipleship is pretty much the soul that is under consideration. They are guided in their choice of workers by a man's personally achieved capacity and by his own hard-won ability. Well, you know, they are not going to waste time choosing us if we don't measure up to their plans at the time, at the moment. It would be a big delay and harmful for those they seek to serve were they to make unwise choices regarding subordinates, co-workers who were subordinates. And DK does tell us that even for disciples such as ourselves, the choice of co-workers will determine the success or failure of a project. When there is capacity, ability, and faculty, then the great ones joyfully employ him. We're always happy to see that someone who has real usefulness appears on the scene and can augment the great effort underway. The wrong angle has been at times overemphasized, and the reverse of this taught. The masters must not be sought because a man seeks capacity. Of course, the master will add capacity, but that's when the man is deeply involved in service. Or at least if the master does not add capacity, he offers opportunity wherein capacity can be developed. They, the masters, will be found when a man has capacity that makes him available for the group work and that can be extended under careful instructions into the higher powers of the soul. So, you know, we have oftentimes a very self-centered approach to the master. Master, give us something, you know. We importune the master instead of, well, this is one of the things that just has so impressed me. Master M says, make yourself indispensable. Make yourself indispensable. And then when a great soul sees someone who really could be indispensable in his work, then, of course, a choice will be made. Well, maybe we will fall short of ultimate indispensability. The old saying is, if you want to see how much you'll be missed, put your finger in the cup of water, remove it, and see what a big hole has been left. On the other hand, this is what the master said. So first, make yourself useful, then highly useful, and then indispensable. Leadership in groups controlling the work of the New Age will grow out of the discipline of the individual, and leaders will be found among those who sense the inner issue. Such wise advice for the carrying on of discipleship. It's almost like, you know, you can't really get into discipleship in the New Age unless you have this foundation of the white magical presentation in this particular book. Leadership that endures does not come to those who strive for place and power, nor for those who have their eyes only on outward conditions and overlook the underlying causes. Leadership does not come to those who place the personal self in its position and power before the good of the group. It comes enduringly to those who seek nothing for the separated self and to those who lose themselves in the good of the whole. So this is one of those summaries which is wise to keep in mind because, you know, many of us will find ourselves in positions of leadership and we have to do it rightly and cannot have false or, you know, secondary motives. So an enlarged channel Above all, they look for an enlarged channel, a soul, mind, brain, make that quite big, right? And for the usefulness of the individual, for the Antis Karana connecting the soul and brain via the mind, and where we can assemble all of these things, the man's self-one capacity, the faculties built and so forth, then the individual will be employed. We can't go looking, we have to help ourselves really here in the world and build up our own capacity through meditation, study, and service, and we cannot expect a bestowal of those things. It would be against the law of karma, I think, to expect that the master will give us what we have not earned. We have to earn our abilities, and then we can be used. Eventually, we will, every server and follower eventually becomes a leader, and leadership, as many things leadership is not, it's not about ambition. It's not just about outer focus. It's selflessness, leadership, you know, the idea is, the server among you will be your leader. And Christ, the true server, is the leader of all. So the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. And the one who is in the position of greatest authority is the one who serves others the most fully. Now he's jumping here back to the sacred word, changing the subject, I think. But those who would cooperate with the hierarchy, they have to cultivate the things we've been, cultivate and express the things we've been talking about here. So now we're resuming our consideration of the AUM. I don't know why he suddenly is going back to that, but there are various places in the books where a fairly extensive treatment of the AUM and OM is found, and in Cosmic Fire it's found, and in the Rays and Initiations, and here we are in a book which is derivative from Cosmic Fire to a degree. The sound or the sacred word, when correctly used, has various effects which might be touched on here. So DK begins to discuss the effects of the not spiritual will, in this case, sacred word, in this case, the Om. Om sounded forth with intent, thought behind it, you know. Even, says Master Moria, take vitamins with consciousness. Don't just pop them in your mouth and hope for the same effect as if you really know what they are intended to do and reinforce that intended effect with your consciousness. So intent, thought is supposed to be behind the sounding of the Om. Acts as a disturber, a loosener of coarse matter, of the body of thought, of emotion, and of the physical body. Well, this is all, we might say that Om is part of the cleansing process. Okay, put that in. An important part of the cleansing process. When sounded forth with intense spiritual aspiration behind it, it acts as an attractive medium and gathers in particles of pure matter to fill the places, notice time and space here, of those earlier thrown out. So the om is ejective and attractive. Ejective and attractive. Students should strive to have these two activities in their minds as they use the word in their meditation. Again, using it with consciousness and with strong intent and with the idea of purpose behind the use. This utilization of the word is of practical value and results in the building of good bodies for the use of the soul. So, it is an issue of health, even. The use of the om is an issue of health. Now, this is one thing the om does. And again, just to keep myself straight, and where am I? Having now held too long on a button? Oh, really held too long. Yeah, so let's here put an A, and here let's put a B. All right, let's see what is said here in the next paragraph. The use of the om serves also to indicate to the workers on the universal planes, I suppose, still on the cosmic physical plane, but we're talking about the cosmic ethers now, and to those in the outer world who are gifted with spiritual perception that a disciple is available for work and can be utilized actively in the needed places of the earth. So, om is a signal. The use of the om is a signal of one's usability or availability. Availability. This should be borne in mind by all aspirants and should serve as an incentive in making the outer phenomenal life coincide with the spiritual impulse. And this is a word, the idea is congruence between the inner intention and aspiration and the outer demonstration. All right. So our availability is signaled by the use of the om. And we do want to be available, right? We do want to be available. Because what's the use of all this training if we're not really available? The use now going on. The use of the sacred word has its place also in the magical work of the hierarchy. Thought forms are created for the embodiment of ideas. Indeed, because thought forms are lesser and more concrete representations of ideas, and these embodied forms are sent forth to contact the minds of the disciples who are responsible in the group of a master for the carrying forward of the plan. So we have to ask, is this sending forth involving the om? And maybe one thinks that indeed it must. Through the cultivated receptivity of the developed and controlled mental body, aspirants become aware of the ideas which the masters bring through from the plane of the universal mind. Now, where would that be? From Atma on up, and hence are in a position to cooperate intelligently. They, in their turn, as this rule seeks to indicate, create thought forms of those received ideas and utilize them in their groups for the helping of the world. So there is a continuous chain of communication or linking. And it starts with ideas and then goes to abstract thoughts. And either the ideas or abstract thoughts are received by the would-be cooperator who builds thought forms intelligently and influences those with whom he must work by these more concrete thought forms. But we need a cultivated receptivity and a developed and controlled mental body. Universal mind, well, at least Atma, you know, and if I were to think even of greater universal mind, I would think of the universe as the solar system, and I would think of the mind of the solar logos, I would think of the cosmic mental plane and the cosmic higher mental plane. Now, the Buddha touched one or the other, or maybe both, I don't know, but certainly the cosmic mental plane, and probably it's not given to so many masters to do that. They would have to be Chohans of a certain kind, and I think their monadic ray would have to be attuned either to the cosmic astral or cosmic mental plane. So, the sacred word apparently can help in this receptivity, you know. So, in all matters of receptivity and of sending, the Om can help. The main work of a disciple on the mental plane is to train himself to do four things. I guess DK is certainly giving us the lists of requirements and what we do with them, and you know how we make use of them is very much up to us. The time equation being more in our hands than we might sometimes choose to think. So training. So this is training. Four aspects of a disciple's training. And, you know, I want to make this very big. Yeah, there it is. And, but I will have to make it bold and highlighted so it can't be missed. The main work of a disciple on the mental plane is to train himself to do four things. One, to be receptive to the mind of the master. He is the monadic point at the center of the ashram. And the creative imagination can help here, as well as the adequate point of tension and the visualization of the connection of the integrated personality with the ashram via the antikarana, and the assumption that an ashram such as Master DK's is found on the Buddhic plane. We don't know on what level of the Buddhic plane, but you know, one tends to think that the higher four sublevels of any elevated plane are the etheric correspondence, the higher correspondence to the four highest levels on the lower planes, and that those are the ones that would, those are the subplanes that would house the efforts of a master, the ashramic efforts. To be receptive to the mind of the master, two, to cultivate a right intuitive understanding of the thoughts sent him by the master, Number three, to embody the ideas received in such form as will be suitable for those he is engaged in helping. And this is right adaptation and speaking proportionately. Sometimes this is really a lesson to learn, you know. It's so easy to just repeat the high thing, but unless it can be interpreted and explained, it will miss the understanding of those who should be understanding and assimilating it. And number four, through sound, light, and vibration, to make his thought form active, embodying as much of the universal thought as is desirable so that other minds may contact it. Now, this is getting more into the correlation with the rule. So, and this requires magical facility. Sound, light, and vibration make his thought form active. Well, that's, you know, that's where we are here. We're in a position to begin, you know, really working in magic. And if I were to go here to a treatise on white magic and just go down a little bit, sound, light, vibration, and the form blend and merge, and thus the work is one. It proceedeth under the law, and naught can hinder the work from going forward. The man breathes deeply, he concentrates his forces, and drives the thought form from him. So there's a lot of internal work involving the soul, but also the man on the outer plane has to become active at a certain point. Well, we have to check in every once in a while with what the rule actually said. So, four aspects of a disciple's training. Receptivity. Right intuitive understanding. Embodying the ideas in appropriate form. And sending. Sending the thought form, using sound, light, and vibration to reach as many as may be possible. Here we are really being trained to be servers, and in the many ways offered by the world, those many ways are appreciated, but something more is being given to us that will really make us esoterically effective. And we know the tremendous power of esotericism when the inner laws are really followed and wielded. A great ability is being placed in our hands at this time, not completely, because more will be given of a magical mantric nature when we've trained ourselves intellectually to understand the process, and when the degree of our sacrifice is greater, and when our purification is greater. Thus, our groups gathered, organized, taught, and lifted, and thus the hierarchy of adepts can reach the world. And we might just say, you know, working through their instruments. It's so easy to get lost in this great pilgrimage of return. And that's why Sanat Kumara, we're told, stays on duty. So even the last weary pilgrim may find his way home. I guess all of this sacrificial behavior has to do with one's true sense of time and eternity and endless duration. Anxiety regarding speed and the amount of time one spends in limited sacrificial conditions has much to do with one's conception of time. When one realizes that we, the it, you know, have been at this forever, that's a great paradox, and will be, and that nothing can prevent us from actually being absolute infinitude, and that nothing can be added to or taken away from absolute infinitude, that we will always be exactly what we are, no matter how we demonstrate in the Mahamayavic worlds, then it changes one's attitude towards sacrifice, changes one's attitude towards the amount of patience one exhibits and the amount of time that one spends dealing with very limited circumstances, which are far indeed from the kinds of environing circumstances which have been promised in the future. So out of love and an extreme patience which comes from the realization of one's own absolute infinitude and of the eternal duration of every life in the one life, from this can come the ability to work properly without undue haste or worry and without any sense of loss that one would lose because one does not, I'll just put it bluntly, hurry up and get it, you know, rush forward, get it, grab it, you know, that's the desire nature prompting us, but, we're already complete. Not in the Mahamayavic world, no, we're not complete there. And that is very compelling, but when one realizes what one really is, then our attitude towards helpfulness over an extended period of time really changes. Yeah. Okay, well, going on a little bit, thus have the groups gathered, organized, and taught and lifted. Those are the words. And we've had experience of this. We've been even, you know, right here in the mode we work with. We've been drawn in, haven't we? We've been somewhat organized. We've been taught by Master DK. And inevitably, we become lifted. There are many other uses, of course, but if the students will ponder on these three, they will make it possible for further uses to be imparted later. Well, now the three, I guess, have to do with an A, B, and C. Okay, three uses of the sacred word. Three uses of the No, I'm just going to have to write it S-A-C-R-W. Maybe that will have to be what it is. S-A-C-R-W. And we'll call it the sacred word. Okay. There are many other uses of the sacred word. Purification, availability, the spreading of ideas as thought forms for the stimulation of the aspirants and disciples. We have to learn our receptivity and understanding what the master sends us and learn how to embody the ideas and forms and spread these thought forms. So there are many other uses, of course, but if the students will ponder on these three, they will make it possible for further uses to be imparted later. So let's not get greedy, because it would never end. We have to assimilate. Greedy, greedy, get. We have to assimilate what we've been given. And let's see, we have to assimilate, yeah, we have to assimilate what we have been given. And as DK said, I've given you more than you can ever absorb. Okay. And Master DK has given us more than we can ever absorb. So let us be content with what has been offered. It is a huge gift, and not always be looking for more and more gathered superficially when we fail to assimilate what has been already offered. And he says, may I add that sound is only truly potent when the disciple has learned to subordinate the lesser sounds, the many voices of the mental and astral plane. Only as the sounds he sends forth normally into the three worlds are reduced in volume and in activity as well as in quantity will it be possible for the sound to be heard, the sound of the monad. And so to accomplish its purpose, only as the multitude of spoken words is reduced, sometimes, you know, as I'm speaking word after word here in this attempt at interpretation and linking, I wonder if I'm not going against the law. Too many words. Only as the multitude of spoken words is reduced and silence in speech is cultivated, interlude, you might say, interlude and a just proportion according to divine purpose, will it be possible for the word to make its power felt on the physical plane? Only when the many voices of the lower nature and of our environment are silenced, will the voice that speaketh in the stillness make its presence felt? Voice of the silence, we can call it, in The Secret of the Golden Flower, you know, by Blavatsky, a very beautiful little book. Only when the sound of many waters dies away, just like the little wavelets which prevent the true image of the sun from reflecting with integrity. Only when the sound of many waters dies away in the adjustment of the emotions will the clear note of the waters be heard. Well, I'll tell you what, that's so beautiful that I'm just going to want to do that again, and not right now. So we're going to call this, what has happened to my, that would be a horrible thing, wouldn't it? Okay, well, friends, almost had a serious mishap here with everything disappearing, but maybe not, maybe not. So, yes, I'm going to reread this paragraph next time. And now I'll just call this, hopefully, this being the right bracket, the end of A Treatise on White Magic video commentary number 32, rule 4.4, page 142, but let's see, where did we start? 132? Is that possible? Or was it 136? I always hate to go looking like this, but I can't seem to help it because I don't remember what I should. So this is a little bit of a delay here, and there we go. And this is up to 132. And now I suppose we have to go to, let's say, number 31, 137, and to 142. All right, that's a little better. Right. If you can bear with me as I try to finish this off, this is page 137 to 141. And we'll call this the beginning of Treatise on White Magic, video commentary number 33, rule 4.5, page 141. Because we have reached a point here where we are talking about the requirements. Only as he does this, only as he does that, only when the many voices die down and we need to repeat them. Did you ever think there could be so many requirements to our, as it says here, our discipleship training? And just as a reminder, we have been studying the uses of the Om, the sacred word. All right, friends. There are little ragged areas here and there, and this is not an entirely made for primetime television presentation, but I hope I'm able to stimulate some thought, and that the intensity of light will increase in all our consciousness, or the consciousness of every one of us. See you soon. Bye.